Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today on the broadcast, pro-business politics in India, profits per square foot everywhere, and as always on a Friday, the Weekly Wrap right here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, everybody, the 16th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us. And what do you say? Let's dive right in, unpack the 5 days gone by. For that, we've got Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Felix Salmon from Fusion, about which, by the way, everybody's got a new job except me. Hey, guys.
Hey, Guy.
I know.
Okay.
I know, right?
Are you looking for a new job?
No.
We might have one for you.
I got in such trouble once when I said that on the radio, and so I am not looking for a new job. Felix, I will start with you, and I come to you, number one, because you're a bond market guy, but number two, because I'm confused. Things are generally going well economically. Most of the indicators are positive or trending that way. And yet people are leaving stocks and buying bonds, which is what they do when they're nervous. Explain.
Well, if you saw the level of the stock market, you might be nervous as well right now. Everything has a price. And I think the reason why they're buying bonds is because the thing which is the risk to bonds, which is inflation, doesn't seem like it's going to turn up anytime soon. So if inflation is low and bonds seem safe while stock market volatility goes up and stocks seem risky, doesn't that make sense to you?
Yeah, you know, maybe I suppose in the abstract, but Catherine, why is there no inflation yet in this economy? I mean, we had consumer price index and PPI out, and on a core basis, right, you take out fuel and energy and food, there's nothing price-wise.
There's still so much slack in the labor force, in the labor market. People aren't getting hired. That's not pushing pressure upward on wages. You know, that's not pushing upward pressure on the things that people buy. I think you really need to see a lot more activity in the economy, particularly in the hiring market, before you really need to worry about inflation.
All right. Well, we shall see on that one. Two less zeitgeisty, more specific questions. Mel Watt, the new director of the FHFA, the oversight agency of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, came out this week and said, listen, we're gonna make it easier, basically. It's convoluted, but we're going to make it easier for people to get mortgages, take out loans, and hopefully boost the housing market that way. Felix, what do you think about that? Is that a safe and a good thing to do?
I've always been suspicious about the U.S. government trying to boost the economy by making houses more expensive. I don't think this is a great technique, but the fact is that if you live in a country with 60-something percent home ownership, all of that, those policies always become very popular politically because people like to see the value of their homes go up.
Yeah, but it's so interesting, Catherine, because the official policy of the United States government, I do believe Mr. Watt's boss, the president, wants to do something about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and make them smaller, right? Reform them and maybe get rid of them?
Yeah, I mean, the administration has thrown its support behind a bill that's kind of dead at this point to wind down Fannie and Freddie, but to replace them with something else, hopefully something more permanent that would encourage home ownership, of course. I mean, it doesn't seem like that policy goal has turned around at all. But, you know, they want to wind down Fannie and Freddie, but not because they want to get rid of the various subsidies that we currently have.
Right. And since winding down Fannie and Freddie is going to happen on the 12th of never, we may as well use them while we've got them.
Right. I will say here, by the way, just to head off the cards and letters, that yes, the FHFA is technically an independent agency. All right. On the way out, Felix, just a sensibility question. What do you think of Tim Geithner's book, The Press Rollout, and all of that, honestly, hoo-ha around the former Treasury Secretary's memoirs?
I am enjoying the book. I haven't finished it. I find it infuriating in parts and suffused with what you might call white technocratic privilege.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad he's written it because it does, as Michael Lewis said in the New York Times, it really makes his personality, it brings it out, and it was hidden for the entire crisis pretty much.
Yeah, well, that's actually true. For my money, too many charts and graphs, but that's neither here nor there. Catherine, thoughts on the Secretary's book before we go?
I have not read it yet, so I'm not sure I have a whole lot to add.
I'll tell you,
I've been following some of the reaction from like Sheila Bair and Yorosky and some of the others who are clearly unhappy about their portrayals in the book. So I'm very intrigued to see some of the political infighting that he portrays or doesn't portray.
I got a copy. I can mail it to you. All right?
Okay, thanks.
Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Felix Salmon from Fusion. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
All right. We'll see you later. Sluggish start to the week, to the day, on Wall Street this Friday. Then people started buying into the close. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Red Lobster, if you'll pardon the tortured metaphor, is getting tossed overboard. Parent company Darden Restaurants is going to sell the seafood chain for about $2 billion. Investors, hedge fund investors to be precise, have been pressuring Darden to sell for months now. And one of them released a statement saying Darden should have sold Olive Garden, too, because it seems the casual dining business ain't all that it used to be. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Red Lobster and its casual dining cousins are in a tough time, says Dan Henkes. He's with the food industry consulting group Technomic.
There's two things. I mean, it's certainly getting squeezed at the higher end by, you know, more of a polished casual, as we would call it.
Think Cheesecake Factory.
And then at the lower end, you've got a extremely high-quality, upscale fast food segment that we call fast casual. So you think Panera's, Chipotle's.
Harry Balzer watches consumer behavior around food for NPD. He says Panera and Chipotle give consumers two things.
It's time and money. Save me time, save me money. And this country has been under pressure for its income for a number of years now. One way we've been able to save money is just don't use restaurants as often. And yet there's all these new restaurants that are opening up, and every time they open the door, someone loses business because the market is not expanding.
Casual dining spots like Red Lobster lose on both counts, time and money. Alex Suskind teaches at Cornell's Hospitality School. The average check at a Red Lobster is about twice as much as Chipotle, and the time you spend there is more than twice as much, 45 minutes to an hour. Even for family dining, that's a stretch.
When I go out with my family, I have two young kids, if we could get out in 35 minutes, it's better.
Olive Garden has the same problem, but he says Red Lobster has an additional burden, demographics.
It's still perceived as a restaurant that your grandma went to.
Even attempts to update the decor, like putting the bar front and center, haven't helped with that. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
As long as we're on the topic of retail performance, there are, of course, a whole lot of ways to measure that. One is to count up how many dollars a given store can wring out of every single square foot of space that it occupies. A company called eMarketer is out with a rank-ordered list of exactly that, sales per square foot. And there were plenty of high-priced chains up at the top, along with a chain that is not so high-priced. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from there.
Apple makes the most money per square foot, $4,551 a foot, according to eMarketer. Seems you don't have to sell many iPads to make $4,500. Ken Perkins is president of Retail Metrics. He says most of the retailers at the top of the eMarketer list sell expensive stuff.
Clearly, the higher-end consumer has more discretionary dollars to spend, you know, driving strong sales per square foot. You don't really see many discounters on here or department stores.
But you do see Murphy USA, which runs a chain of gas station convenience stores. It came in second. Weird, right? Maybe not, according to Gary Rosenberger of EconoPlay, who follows these kinds of trends. I caught up with him on the road.
And ironically enough, I just filled up at a Murphy's convenience store in Dillon, South Carolina.
Rosenberger says the place was packed. About 10 people were in line ahead of him.
And everybody there was online basically to buy either lottery tickets or cigarettes.
Rosenberger says Murphy sells lots of people, lots of stuff. But there's another reason the retailers on this list are profitable. Most of them don't have to worry about online competition, and they're making their stores a destination. Take Restoration Hardware, for example. Nicole Perrin is the executive editor of eMarketer.
They've been, you know, fairly explicit about that, saying, you know, we want people to come in, spend time here, hang out here.
They're adding restaurants and rooftop gardens to some stores. Anything to squeeze out one more dollar per square foot. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was a time in American capitalism when social responsibility, doing good, was actually part of many a company's culture, part of their bottom line. That changed in 1970 when economist Milton Friedman published an essay in the New York Times entitled "The Social Responsibility of Business is to Increase Its Profits." 40-some-odd years later, the pendulum seems to have swung back the other way a bit with the rise of a specific business structure called the Benefit Corporation. Sally Herships has this one.
I was at an interview recently talking to Mike Brady, the CEO of a company in Yonkers, New York, but I had to stop because... I'm sorry, what is that smell?
That would be remnants of brownies.
Brady works for Grayston Bakery. It makes 30,000 pounds of brownies a day for Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
So this is our freezer area.
Wow.
Won't spend much time in here, but this is...
Oh my God!
Right, this is where you'd see all the brownies after they're made.
But Grayston isn't a typical company. It's a benefit corporation. That means in addition to normal requirements, Grayston also has to create a, quote, material positive impact on society and the environment. It has solar panels on its roof, buys sustainable cocoa and sugar. And when jobs open up, anyone gets the chance to work, no questions asked. Companies can now become benefit corporations in 22 states. But how do you reconcile a social mission with a bottom line?
I could spend 100% of my time trying to figure out the solutions for selling a good product, but I dedicate my time and the time of my team to focus on how we can improve the environment and the community, ultimately hoping that that's going to lead to us selling more products, and that's been the case so far.
The bakery sold almost $10 million of brownies last year. Eric Trojan is with B-Lab, a nonprofit that certifies benefit corporations.
The unique thing of a benefit corporation is it deregulates the purpose of a corporation by saying you can consider other factors than profit. You can consider society and the environment in addition to profit.
Trojan says benefit corporations have to answer to shareholders, just like traditional corporations, so they can be held accountable for doing good. But because traditional companies have to maximize shareholder profits, it's difficult to focus on anything else. Lynn Stout teaches corporate law at Cornell. She disagrees with that last part.
Well, it turns out the purpose of the corporation is to do, and I'm taking this right from what the vast majority of corporate charters say. They say the purpose of the corporation is to do anything lawful.
Stout says we don't need benefit corporations, but they do have some benefits. She says there's a saying in business, what you measure is what you manage. And if all you're measuring is profits, that is naturally going to be your focus. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, the changing ways of Wall Street's reputation. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 44 points today, 0.25%, closed at 16,491 after a slow start to the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 21 points, 0.5%, finished at 4,090. The S&P 500 made it a clean sweep, added on 7 points, 0.3%, wrapped up at 1,877. Still not a good week for the markets. The Dow's strong finish couldn't keep it out of the red for the week, and although the S&P 500 rose above 1,900 for the first time ever on Tuesday, ended things almost exactly where it started the week. Shares of the wrestling league WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, got clotheslined. Projected losses of more than $30 million over the next 2 years sent its stock down 43% today. Bond prices, since we were talking about them, the yield on the 10-year, 2.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Students from around the country are in Washington to compete in the annual National Geographic Beach Championships. The winner gets to go to the Galapagos Islands. Now, point to it on a map. Campbell's Soup Company releases quarterly earnings. And actor Peter Mayhew turns 70. We look forward to seeing him again as Chewbacca. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Sensex, the benchmark index on the Bombay Stock Exchange, had quite a day today, up more than 5% before a late-day fade as the results of that country's elections rolled in. Narendra Modi will be India's next prime minister in what can safely be called a sea change over there. Sutrajit KK is the editor of Quartz India. We got him on the line from New Delhi. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Mr. Modi focused, as do many winning candidates in a slowing economy, on reviving that economy. How exactly is he going to do that?
So you're absolutely right in that that was indeed his campaign plank. The broad expectation from him stems not so much from what he has spelled out, as much as from his record in the state of Gujarat, where he has been chief minister, which would be the equivalent of a governor in the U.S. Mm-hmm. for the past, you know, close to 13 years now. And, I mean, it has always done better historically compared with many other states. But Modi has undeniably done a lot of good developmental work in Gujarat.
Well, what has he done in Gujarat? I mean, how has he changed that place?
So fundamentally, he has provided better governance than investors and business people get to experience in most other states. There is excellent infrastructure in terms of roads, power, water, and all of that. There is no history of labor strife. It has been a prosperous state, but he has managed to work quite hard to attract a lot of foreign investment into the state.
This is a guy who grew up selling tea in railway stations. Fair to call him pro-business?
That's absolutely right. In that sense, it's an inspirational human story. But more than that, Modi politically comes from a right-wing party, but its underlying organization used to profess a very different kind of economics early on, which focused on self-reliance and boycotting American products, etc., etc. Mm. But Modi has completely changed that economic philosophy, and he has completely modeled himself after Reagan or a Thatcher.
Wow.
And that's very reassuring to businessmen.
What about the Indian population, though? It's trending younger now. It's more urban than it used to be. It's got globalization to deal with. How are they going to react to the next 5 years of their lives under Prime Minister Modi?
I think the changing demographics of India is precisely what has delivered a thumping victory to Modi today. The pitch of the incumbent Congress party, which had ruled for the last 10 years, has always been that we are a party for the poor. We are doling out, and you need us to survive. And Modi's pitch has always been that, okay, we need to get rid of this kind of welfareism. Growth will pick people up from poverty, and what we need to ensure is, an opportunity for everybody to progress, etc. So, younger people got more and more impatient with the Congress party's attitude.
Here comes the bureaucratic question, right? I mean, India is enormous. It's got a large bureaucracy. It does not do things quickly. How successful do you think he's going to be able to be?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. In Gujarat, what has happened is he has been able to make the bureaucracy work. How he does it, I don't know. I mean, he's a workaholic. He picks people. He does various different things. But the advantage here is that Modi now has absolute control of the government and a big majority in parliament. The size of mandate the people has given him gives him so much political stature that people expect that he'll be able to push through things and, get the bureaucracy to deliver what he needs to be done.
Sutrajit KK, he is the editor of Quartz India. We got him in New Delhi today. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Congressman Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Budget Committee and just maybe an entrant in the 2016 presidential sweepstakes, gave a speech today. Poverty was his topic of choice, specifically how to figure out whether what the government is doing to fight it is working. 46 million Americans live below what is called the poverty line, but where to put that line, how to figure it out, is the subject of no small amount of disagreement. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King reports.
Many poverty researchers will tell you the way we measure poverty is wrong. We use a formula, and that formula...
it's way out of date.
Tim Smeeting directs the Institute for Research on Poverty.
It doesn't take account of the actual expenditures of the poor for food, clothing, and shelter.
The formula is based on how poor people spent money in 1963. Molly Orshansky, a statistician with the Social Security Administration, devised it only a year later. She looked at a mock-up menu the Department of Agriculture put together to show people how to eat on a tight budget. Beans, potatoes, eggs, not much meat. Orshansky added up how much the food would cost for a year
and multiplied it by three.
Patricia Ruggles is an economist with NORC, a social science organization at the University of Chicago.
At that time, there was data from consumption surveys that showed that the average family spent about a third of their income on food.
And that is still how we measure poverty. What you need for food times three. Earn less than that, you're poor. Chris Tilley directs UCLA's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. I asked him to take a look at that old food plan as we went to do our own budget shopping in a local supermarket.
The local white potatoes, that's $1.69 a pound. The pinto beans look like they're the best bargain here, $2 for $3 for a bag of beans. It's $2 and change for a dozen eggs.
You do the math and it's clear. These days, food does not account for a third of a normal family's budget.
Housing's gotten more expensive. Healthcare has gotten more expensive. Gas is pretty expensive. So multiplying the food budget by three no longer makes a lot of sense.
A few years ago, the Census Bureau started publishing something called the Supplemental Poverty Measure. It takes into account details that the federal formula doesn't. Whether you live in a city where rents are high or low, what you spend on childcare and commuting. If you receive benefits like food stamps and subsidized housing, which lifts some people above the line. Patricia Ruggles says if you use the supplemental measure,
you don't have vast numbers more people living below the poverty line.
But the face of who is struggling changes when you take work expenses into account. Consider this guy who sometimes grabs a free meal at the Midnight Mission, a human services organization in Los Angeles.
Some chicken pasta salads, some fresh strawberries, and some rice, some meat, some veggies, the whole thing. Looks really good, actually.
Ryan Navalis isn't a client. He works here full-time advocating for the homeless. He loves his job and says he earns fair wages, but he has a lot of expenses.
It costs money to dry clean the clothes I have to wear, and it costs money to get back and forth on public transportation. It costs money to pay for childcare, healthcare. You know, these are everyday things. And then we want to talk about rent.
The supplemental poverty measure does a better job of reflecting that lots of working people have trouble making ends meet. But the government sticks with the old formula, partly because of politics. States get billions of dollars from the federal government based in part on how many poor residents they have. Tim Smeeting of the Institute for Research on Poverty says, imagine you're the governor of South Dakota, and now the poverty formula takes into account that Sioux Falls is cheaper than San Francisco.
It's not rocket science to figure out that, hey, I'm going to have way fewer poor people and I'm going to get less money. There's too much at stake in terms of transfers from the federal government to the states. Even if everyone knows that the current way we measure poverty is just wrong and out of whack.
However you look at it, there's only one official federal poverty line. There are different takes on whether it's the best one, just as there are different takes on how to tackle poverty itself. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Let it be said for the benefit of the higher-ups at American Public Media that we here at Marketplace never but never ignore all staff emails from the bosses. One could imagine, though, that sometimes at other places, memos like that do go unread. At Deutsche Bank, that is now a little bit harder to do. Cullen Fan, the co-head of Deutsche Bank's investment arm, sent a video message to his employees about how they communicate.
Let's be clear. Our reputation is everything. Being boastful, indiscreet, and vulgar is not okay.
He was talking about emails and texts and conversations that time and time again have proved embarrassing for oh so many big financial firms under investigation. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
Judge not, lest ye be judged, the quote goes. An updated version might say text not, lest ye be judged, and email not, and GChat not.
People are shocked at what their emails look like later out of context.
Henry Blodgett is editor of Business Insider, but he also spent a decade working on Wall Street.
There's a lot of tension and there's a lot of yelling and screaming and gamesmanship, and it certainly lends itself to the very colorful emails and texts that we've seen.
Some were illegal, others crass, plenty were both, and all made the firms look terrible. But it also, according to anthropologist Karen Ho, encourages people to behave terribly or even illegally.
The boasting and the vulgarity help to create a perverse motivational environment where traders do their talk, their texts, their emails, their yelling are egged on.
Ho argues that blaming Wall Street excesses on greed lets the culture off the hook.
But the good news is that if it's cultural and folks are socialized into it, then hopefully they can also be socialized out of it.
Something the Deutsche Bank video is expressly trying to do. Goldman Sachs actually installed a filter to prevent people from sending emails with curse words.
So they kind of installed willpower via software.
This is Kevin Roos, author of Young Money.
I think it has to come from the top, like any cultural shift within an organization.
And it will probably require people getting fired, which, from the tone of the Deutsche Bank all staff, sounds pretty likely. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
This final note today, in which we will all flash back to our teenage selves. Those awkward days when we could do nothing right, when mortification lurked at every turn and complete disgrace was only a heartbeat away. Well, was for me anyway, but I digress. Researchers have apparently found the exact age when we are most likely to be maximally embarrassed, peak embarrassment, they actually call it. 17.2 years of age is it, and the study, embarrassingly enough for me, came out last year in the journal Psychological Science. And with that, you now know too much about me. Also, we gotta go. That's Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We will see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.